the Forged and Unbroken podcast.
I think we're pretty similar in line. How many years you got on now?
So 11, 10 and a half in DC, and 22 and a half years, almost 23 in total in the fire department. So 11 there, almost.
Yeah, yeah. And you're over on the shore as well, right, Berlin?
Yeah, well, so we just moved from Berlin to Salisbury, so not volunteering there anymore. But that just happened recently. So, yeah, unfortunately.
That's a little bit closer. It's a little bit nicer drive then for you, huh?
A little bit. It saves a little bit of time, but not much. Yeah.
That's good. Now, talking about the DC rescue squad culture, let's just back up. I mean, DC is like steeped in history, right?
Yeah.
How would you explain, I guess, where did the rescue squad concept start in DC?
I think things started there with, along the same lines of the other companies just needing a more specialized unit, guys that were more experienced initially just for the search and rescue aspect of things. And then, you know, the progression of the fire service in general started to take on more tasks with vehicle extrications and the more specialized training. So like Rescue Squad 3 that I'm assigned to, they do, we're the primary response unit for collapse and trench for anything in the city. And then Rescue Squad 1 does ropes, and Squad 2 does all of the confined space stuff. So each one of the rescue squads has their own primary discipline. And then on top of that, we all have, you know, the other disciplines that we're required to maintain. So collapse, trench, swift water. So basically anything like that would come in, we would be the primary on. And then for fires, we're the search company.
Gotcha. Okay. So let's split that out a couple of different ways. So one, you're all part of the special operations community, right? So
yeah.
This basic, I don't want to say basic, but you all have a standard that you all have to meet. And then within each of those, you all have your own specializations, so to speak.
Right? Yeah. So there are seven battalions in the city. Six of those are geographically defined. And then 7th battalion would be the special operations battalion, which is the three rescue squads, the hazmat unit, and the fireboat. And, you know, obviously those guys take care of the fireboat and the hazmat unit. They have, you know, they kind of dig more into the water rescue or hazmat side of things, but they also receive the same training so that they can work together with us on the specific incidents. But yeah, like we are at Squad 3, we're more responsible for the collapse and trench. So we focus on that. We have additional vehicles for that. And, you know, same for the other units, like Squad 2 has their own setup for confined space. They have the BG4 stuff for tunnel entry and all that. So.
Yeah. What is the, what section of the city are you based out of?
So Squad 3 being Anacostia, which is in southeast. So southeast of the river. So we take care of the 2nd and 3rd battalion as our primary response. But, you know, there's only 3 squads in the city. So if things get busy, it's easy to get pulled across the river into other sections of the city.
Yeah. And now box alarm response. What is, I mean, there's just one rescue. Well, one squad on a box alarm, typically, correct? On like the first alarm, and then which are the primary responsibilities?
Yeah, so 5 engines, 2 trucks, 1 rescue, and then 2 chiefs for a box alarm and some additional units. Our primary responsibility is search and rescue for civilians. And then if there were to be a firefighter mayday, then we would divert from that to address the mayday situation. We have a staffing of 5 on the rescue companies, minimum. So sometimes it could be heavy, but usually it's 5. So you have the officer and one member from the back or the A team, and then the other 2 would be the B team. Typically it's shift by shift, company by company, but like my shift, you know, things have changed a little bit. Our A team goes above the fire. So, you know, if you had a 2-story row, the one team goes to the fire. So in our case, the team B would go to the fire. Team A goes above. They're stance behind that is that the officer is able to make some decisions and, you know, potentially working above the fire in a dangerous situation. So 2 members there for search, 2 members to the fire, and then the squad driver goes wherever is needed. So.
Nice. Okay. Yeah. Really good split out. I want to go down this rabbit hole really quick. The area that you're typically responding to, because DC has got, I mean, so much to offer as far as just building construction history.
Absolutely.
What's going on for your section of the city? Like, what's your common response that you're going to? What kind of structures are you typically finding yourself in?
We have a really good mixture of 2-story rows, And then what we call two up and two down, where you walk in the front door and you have two apartments on the first floor, one to the left, one to the right. The stairwell goes up, and then two apartments on the second floor. And then we have a lot of two, three, four story apartment buildings. And then we have a few high rises. It's not many, but a couple 10, 11 story buildings. But for the most part, two story rows. We do have a good number of one or two story single families as well. So yeah, not as much of the high rise stuff, not as much commercial stuff, more so residential.
Yeah. That's where all the fun's at though.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now I want to dig into this little piece, cause I think this is pretty different depending on the department you're in. So let's talk about getting assigned to the rescue. So there's a lot of departments, you know, I'm one of them where typically there's not a lot of say, like, yeah, that maybe the house captain can start putting out some feelers about who they might want to come in. Anybody can put a transfer in. Between captains and battalions, you might get a little bit of say in who comes there, but by and large, it could be from battalions or assistants above you that are going to, they're going to say what it is that can happen and who can come into the company. And I know that there's a wide variance between specialized units across the nation.
Yeah.
How does DC do it?
So we're actually in a really unique transition period right now with that process, but I'll give you a little bit of what we used to do and what they're in the process of doing now. So when I was assigned to the rescue, there was a, you submit your special report with the intention to try and join the company. And then you take a written test. After you get scored for that and get ranked, then you take a swim test, an interview process with a panel, and then they take all those scores and you get ranked on that list. As a vacancy in the company became available, they would detail you from your company. So like at the time I was assigned to Engine Company 15, I would be assigned to a 90-day detail in the company on the where the vacancy had occurred. And then you have 90 days to basically essentially complete the rescue squad rookie book, the 90-day book is what they call it. And that has all the skills that they want you to be able to be, you know, minimally proficient at least be able to understand the basic concepts of, you know, doing some shoring for a collapse, working through trench stuff, being able to cut a car, or you know, basic ropes and knot systems and stuff like that, be able to perform a search proficiently. And then at the end of that, you would take a test, a practical test and a written test. And if you pass that process, then you would be able to be assigned to the company. So for the last 5 years or so, the different leadership throughout the division has been working on a rescue school concept, which is finally started about probably 6 weeks ago, I think, for the first time. And it's a 14-week program where the guys go in and they're given all of the same criteria that you would require for the 90-day test. But at the same time, you're also getting collapse technician certification. You're getting swift water technician. You're getting all the different minimum class standards at the technician level, so that when you're done, you're able to not only perform as a member of the company, but you have the certifications behind it. So, and then they'll be ranked and fill in vacancies as they occur. So we're in the middle of that process right now with the rescue school going. This week they're in rope rescue class, so advanced ropes. So
gotcha. And you're teaching a lot of that, right? Or you're getting
I have been involved in some of it with vehicle education and search, and then collapse and trench. So
yeah,
busy schedules.
Yeah, no kidding, man. And that's I was telling you about my one buddy who's in there, who is going through that process. I know he's been loving it, but it seems like a pretty high standard. Like I appreciate that. And then by the time you get out by the end of it, it's going to be a rank order list, and they get pulled as the vacancies come up from the companies. Is that right?
Yep. So that's the plan.
Yeah. Pretty cool. That's pretty wild. For that, I know you've gotten into you kind of mentioned the school prep stuff. This 14 week, you said this is the first time it's been done.
Yeah.
And before that, it was, you had the 90 day, and it was, for lack of better words, was it more handpicked?
I mean, you still had to do the test, written test. You had to do the
swim
test. So there are some minimal entry criteria. And then, you know, wherever you fell on the list, it was where you would be one, two for that. So,
okay.
You know, it's kind of neat.
Yeah, for sure. Now, man, just over, I feel like the last year, not even the last year, the last 6 months, man, the DC squads have been just getting it in between. I mean, there's been some notable house fires and rescues. There's been some, the crash You know, out in front of Reagan, like you guys have been putting your money where your mouth is. How has that, I mean, just for the last little bit, some of these notable incidents here, like how are guys performing? What are some of the things that you're getting involved with that most people don't even realize? Because DC and the surrounding areas has so much to offer, man. Like, yes, the house fire with rescue, I feel like, is the bread and butter, but there's so much that goes above and beyond that that you're finding yourselves tasked with.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you mentioned the plane crash. Like, you know, a lot of our guys were involved in that in some form or fashion, as far as responding initially, being out on the water on the boats, helping with you know, with recovery efforts there. You know, so that's a pretty heavy hit for the guys, and you know, we're working through that. The department's been really great about support from the mental health aspect of that, because that was, you know, really truly a once in a lifetime kind of call. So I wasn't involved in that at all, which I, you know, looking back at it now, thankful that I wasn't involved in some parts of that. You know, over the course of my career, I've had that black cloud of being a part of some pretty bad stuff. So as much as you want to be there and help, you know, sometimes it's better to not be there. And it's kind of a, you know, it's a double-edged sword to talk about, because you definitely want to be there to help support your guys. From that aspect, I, you know, I wish I was there to help, but given the condition of things and how things worked out for that, it's just, it's a tough one for everybody that was there. And like I say, thankfully the department's been really helpful with supporting them and trying to give them the help that they need. So that's a good thing. But, you know, between that, they've had, you know, our dive team is in its infancy, that they're not, you know, being assigned to the rescue company, you're not required to be a diver, but the dive guys have really shown their value tremendously in the last couple months between the plane crash and then there are some other, you know, incidents where they've just stepped up and shown that. So, but there's a price to pay for that. You know, those guys have dealt with some crazy stuff and just, you know, trying to be there to support those guys and help. But yeah, I mean, the bells go off every day for something that you just, you're like, oh gosh, I, you know, can't believe that we're involved in the cool stuff. I mean, you know, we say it's cool. Like, we train and work really hard to be prepared for this stuff. So when it happens, it's good to be a part of and be able to use your skills and showcase that. And, you know, there was a car that ran into a building up in Bunker Hill Road Northeast. The car takes a wall down. It catches on fire. The building's on fire. There's a lady trapped inside. And the guy from Rescue Squad 2, our CLAPS guys end up responding. And Squad 2 gets in there and puts a rip bag on this lady and helps work her out of a car. And just some remarkable once-in-a-lifetime stuff. Is just kind of crazy how it's been happening lately. But
yeah, you got to find, like, that's one thing I've always appreciated from that mentality, is how you have to really think outside the box, but then also use just common everyday tactics to make, and like the jack of all trades, I know, is the easy saying, right? But you got to take really complex situations and parse them out and chunk them down, so that way you can.
Yeah. Well, just, you know, I know that I spoke on it. I'm pretty sure that you spoke on it as well when we were at Key City in Frederick a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, we're required to maintain proficiency in a lot of areas, and these skills are definitely perishable. So you have to be on top of your game and active and all that stuff. And we're capable of building complex systems and really building things out when we need to, but we're still trying to follow the KISSET method. We're still trying to keep it as simple as we possibly can. And you could really go down a neat rabbit hole of mastery of the basics doesn't require advanced tactics a lot of the time. So when you really think about mastery of basics and you take it to the next level of, like, you know, for the engine company, running a line, like, sure, that can be a basic thing. But when you start breaking down the steps of making sure that your crew members understand their role for different hose lengths or different stretches or different obstacles and what the plans are for that, is it fire on the second floor? Is it fire on the fifth floor? Those little key elements of communicating and breaking that down, while it's basic, it still can be a complex thing. But if you really dig into it and master that, man, like, watching the guy, like, the DC Engine Company is a beautiful thing to watch those guys run the lines, because they do it so well. They're so well versed in it. It's a really neat conversation when you talk about three guys putting 400 feet of line in service that's a pre-connect, and it happens, you know, it's almost like, I don't want to use the orchestra type of thing, but it really is like kind of just a flow kind of thing that happens. And when you have that conversation with people that are not familiar with that, like, how in the world does that happen? Like, if you have a conversation with putting that much hose in service for the guys in New York, they're like, hey, you know, that's two engine companies working together to put the first line of service. It's not that they can't do it. They just operate differently than us, and they're not running the pre-connected line like we are. So it's just different. But those guys are doing it so much that it, even though it's a basic thing, mastery of the basic requires not an advanced thing. You know, so for, like same thing for us with our RIT operations. You know, I hope that we never have to deploy RIT bag, but we practice on that so much to make sure that we're proficient in every part of that process so that if it ever does, we're ready.
Yeah, God forbid. Yeah, you know. You remove any doubt and any questions. The word I like to use is virtuosity. It's doing the common uncommonly well.
Absolutely.
And you are putting it out on the street. It, like you said, it looks so simple, but these guys are taking in so much information and they're combating all these little loopholes or like error trapping so many little things as they're running a line down the street and they make it seamless. But professionals are, yeah, just taking in so much information and are managing any little curveball that they can get thrown. And I'm sure like our minds are on fire while we're doing it. But yeah,
absolutely. The
execution of which is super simple. But let's dig into that, man, because you had a really awesome presentation with the dedication, discipline, and details. Some of the hallmark messaging, because you get out there and you do a lot of training for whether it's for DC or traditions, and you get to see a lot of regional stuff. You get to rub elbows with a lot of really cool people. Between that program and then what you are just getting to see out there, like what are these hallmark messages that you're trying to drive home with that program and with all the other things that you're doing? I know that's a big question, but
man,
however you need to.
It could go so many different ways, but I got to tell you, man, like the first thing that comes to my mind is just being willing to continue bettering yourself and really trying to push the bar, trying to take it to the next level. It's not, you know, it's 2025. We're not reinventing anything at this point. We're just trying to get really good at the things that we should be good at. And, you know, we had some conversations there about aggressiveness and stuff like that. Aggressiveness can be miscued as just running down the street fast. And don't get me wrong, like we're coming off the rigs moving with purpose and intention because the citizens that we serve, the people that we work with deserve that. But my thought process on aggressiveness has changed to basically be overly proficient at our job. And that starts with like being willing to go inside a building that's on fire when everybody else is running out. I think that's a huge step that we just overlook. Like you sign up to be a fireman, that means you're going to run into a building when it's on fire and go do work. And, you know, understanding your skill set, understanding your job function. It's a little different in a city where you're putting that staffing factor of five engines, two trucks, rescue, two chiefs, ambulance, supervisor, medic unit. You know, they're putting like 40 some guys, if you take discount the guys that will be inside the building within a matter of minutes. It's real easy to say that, you know, if everybody does their one job or one piece of the puzzle, that the fire's going to go out, because it usually happens that way. You know, the fear there is if someone missteps or a unit's out of place or there's a delay, how does that affect the operation? But when you compare that conversation to Rural Fire Department USA, the conversation changes drastically. You know, where my buddy John from Indiana was just in town and he's like, yeah, man, we have like seven guys from our company, from our department, on the first alarm, on a box alarm. So they're just calling for help right out the gate. And when you think about what you have to do there, you know, it takes me back to being on a fire in Fenwick, but in North Ocean City, where they have a two-story house, fire on the second floor. And the guys there, it was like an engine company and a couple extra helpers off the break, and they're stretching a line. They're forcing the door. They're trying to do a search as they go. They're venting the windows. They find a lady after they put the fire out, and then the same guys end up transporting the ambulance. Like the only thing they didn't do was dispatch the call. So when you look at workload and what's actually, you know, able to do, it really ties into a lot of what your message was about. Are you really prepared, not just knowing the skills, being able to perform them, but physically to do the job that we do? You know, it's just it's a really deep conversation. So,
yeah. That just reminded me of something. I've talked to a handful of guys in more rural areas. You know, we may vary in degree, but not kind. And so I guess what I mean by that is DC's well-resourced. A lot of the Mid-Atlantic departments are.
Yeah.
I mean, you coming from the Eastern Shore of Maryland, probably not getting 40 guys in 5 minutes,
no,
right?
No, heck no.
I have places that, you know, guys that I've met in West Virginia that, you know, you get a company or two on scene, like that's all you've got for a while. So yeah. It's even more important, more imperative that you lean in instead of step back when some of these calls are happening. I'm sure you've probably experienced that on the shore. Like how are you able, or how are you trying to influence guys' mindsets to lean in when these things are happening? Because I think all too often the easy thing, even for some of our slower battalions where I'm at, it's easy to take those things for granted, right? To be a little bit slower, not have the call volume.
Yeah.
You know, how are you keeping guys and gals around you like motivated, disciplined, creating awareness? You know, how does that look in the firehouse and even operationally?
Yeah, I mean, when you talk to guys in the district about running hand lines, and you know, that's something that they do every day, and then you talk to a guys from a volunteer company or a smaller career company or whatever, with Eastern Shore or wherever, and you know, they're not getting the opportunities to stretch on a live incident, you have to revert to training more often and maintain the muscle memory. You know, the fire department is ineptly dealt a hand of variables that we have no control over every time the bells go off. So, you know, having your gear laid out, if it's on the rig and you're able to get dressed the same way every time matters, you know, masking up the same way it matters. We talked for a while in that conference about masking up with gloves on, and it's neat to hear afterwards, like, hey man, you made me consider things from a different perspective. Might not change your mind, but at least there's a thought process there. Being able to know what your other guys on your crew are going to do, and just having some sort of a flow with the plan for what your job functions are, that helps remove some of the variables, because we can't control the weather. We can't control how long they wait before they call. We can't control where they're at in the house, if there's somebody trapped or not, fire conditions, you know, the hoarding conditions or the building construction types. There are a lot of things that we don't have control over. So the variables that we can control, we really should take rein of that. You know, you have responsibility to train to a certain level and to be physically fit and to be working towards that stuff, because your family deserves it just as much as mine does, just as much as the citizens that we serve. So
the standard is a standard.
Yeah, absolutely. It doesn't matter what the name on the front of the building is. It doesn't matter how many people you have. We still have the same obligation regardless.
Yeah. Hell yeah. Yeah. You talked about the attention being the details. You told a cool story. Actually, and I know one of your guys, he was talking to me. He's like, that's my squad daddy talking about you, talking about the mask up drill. Right. So, you know, it's creating a little bit of friendly competition on the firehouse floor can sometimes do wonders. You know, I say peer pressure is a powerful drug. You know, what started as like, hey, let's see how fast I can do this, it just starts growing. Right. And you were doing that with the mask up stuff, but that could be anything.
Sure. Yeah. You know, and I like, you know, talking about that story, I literally was just trying to get a video showing that masking up with gloves on efficiently in 15, 18 seconds is possible without any kind of crazy step or anything like that, just because I personally feel like it's important. And there's no judgment against someone who doesn't want to wear their gloves. Whatever, to each their own. I just have my own personal reasons based on my experiences, what I've seen on fires, that I feel like it's important. But the biggest thing behind that was, when you have created a level of comfort and competency with your gloves on, if you find yourself in a situation where you need that little bit of extra dexterity or something's going sideways, your first instinct isn't to pull your gloves off because you're not comfortable with it. So all the other reasons aside, guys getting cut with glass or getting hurt or, you know, whatever, you know, back in my beginning days in DC, we were, you know, the first and third new company were running down the street together, trying to get to the front door. So even if it wasn't on fire, there was a competitive level there to be like, hey man, I beat you. I would have had the fire if it was on fire, even if, you know, if it wasn't a building on fire. But now it's bigger than that. It's about making sure that we're confident so that when things go sideways, you're able to do that job and not have to worry about getting hurt or making things worse. So I was taking that video in the firehouse, and my lieutenant comes around the corner and he's like, hey, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm just trying to get a video of a decent mask up. It doesn't have to be anything setting the world on fire. And next thing you know, due to the nature of our company and our house. Our house is an aggressive house in itself. Our guys are always ready to get out the door quickly. They pride themselves on protecting the citizens in our battalion in our area. Yeah, you know, next thing you know, there's a sergeant, there's a rookie, there's a lieutenant, and there's a backstep fireman. And they're all masking up together. They all did it four different ways, and they were all sub 17 seconds for masking up with gloves on. So it was just really cool to see, like, hey, here are a couple of different options. My way is not the only way, but it's possible, and it's a cultural thing for a lot of guys there. So,
yeah, I appreciate that, and I like the room for you have your own style. You're still meeting the standard. You're still keeping a tight timeline, and you're doing it. That works, makes sense for you, right? Sometimes you force certain things on certain people, and it's just not the way their brain works.
Yeah, I mean, you literally watched that video four different times, and all four of those guys masked up differently. There are little things that they do differently for themselves.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, they all achieve the goal within that time frame, and they're able to, working towards, like we talked about, and it was really funny in the presentations, Chief Riley gets up there and starts talking about the four stages of learning. And then I'm like, dude, I have the same exact thing in my presentation. It's really cool on that side of things. You know, when you're able to travel around some and do these presentations and speak with people, to hear other guys who are far more vetted and much more on a big name scale nationally traveling around, who are speaking about the same exact things that, little guys like me and you were talking about. But it's cool to hear the same thing kind of beat up throughout the day, that, you know, attention to basics matters, you know, understanding the learning concepts and how to deliver new content to your guys and how to be better about it. But getting to the level of unconscious competence where I can perform a skill so well because I've done it so many times that I don't have to think about it. It frees up brain space for you to process other things. So with that, masking up, whether it's with your gloves on or not, if you're able to mask up proficiently the same way and you've built such a muscle memory that when you're in front of the building, you know, I prefer to stand instead of getting down on my knees. I'll be standing facing the building. And instead of focusing on the process of masking up, I'm able to use that time to size the building up and take in as much information about what's going on. Where is the fire? Where is the smoke coming from? Do I see something? You know, I was fortunate enough to see a lady sticking her arms through the smoke one time, and we were able to relay that information and work together and get a lady out of a building. I don't know if I would have saw that if I was looking down at the ground and not paying attention differently. So, you know, just being able to free up that brain space to focus on another part, you know, not so much multitasking because I'm performing this task seamlessly. I'm thinking about other things, be able to read the building and get that information about what I need to do to affect where I'm going to go. Like, I feel like it just brings a lot of value.
Yeah. That's such an important nuance, man. I appreciate you saying that. The fact that you've streamlined so many things, that those basics are so fundamental and so streamlined and so second nature that you can take in more information.
Yeah.
It can be that split second of seeing the arms. Oh, I can go affect change now because I can take in more information. Like, how imperative is that we do, man?
Yeah, and you know, you can even take that a step further. It's not just with the masking up and sizing up the building, but like there's a guy, Andrew Huberman. He's a neuroscientist. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him or not, but Joe Rogan had him on his podcast, mm-hmm. and they're talking about unconscious genius, the same exact thing, right? And he's like, I'll be kickboxing in a fight, and, you know, you could tell by the way this guy rotated his body that what he was going to do next. And he's like, my brain didn't even have time to think through the process, and my body responded because it recognized the pattern.
Yeah.
And that pattern recognition, a lot of that affects what we do, you know? So recognizing a pattern influences your direction you're going to move, or in our case, recognizing certain conditions are going to dictate where we're going to move or how we're going to place the line of service this way, or how we're going to vent, or how we're going to search. You know, we talk about for us, that the smoke and fire conditions dictate how close we maintain our communication for a search. You know, if things are light, we can walk and move through the building, not necessarily down on the floor, and be able to move quickly through the building, not being right next to each other. If the conditions get a little bit worse, we're going to be in the same room, but not necessarily hand to hand. You know, that whole firefighter one, I'm holding your ankle thing doesn't exist.
Yeah.
We're moving through the building. But then, you know, we get to a situation where conditions are a little questionable. You know, we may be with the door closed in the same unit, perform a search, and then open that door, take a look with the camera, check the conditions. The thermal layer is okay. The next room's across the hall. On three, we're going to open the door and move. Like, those conditions are going to dictate that. Sometimes that all plays a part in it too. So,
yeah. Yeah. I'm going to toss this one up to you because I love the pattern recognition stuff. And I feel like 90% of the time when we have our systems and processes in place, it's going to help us immensely because we can recognize the patterns we have in the environment. We see them within ourselves, within the team. Yeah. And it makes us more efficient. There's this thing called the adaptability paradox, though, where you sometimes will try to force your patterns into a new model that doesn't work. Right. Yeah. So how, like, what is your mindset telling you, or how are you teaching your people that, okay, if I'm forcing a pattern into a new situation, it's not working. Some people start going, they try to just force it harder. Right. So how are you taking a step back and recognizing, okay, I need to try something new here, or pull something from a totally different tactic that normally would be applied to the situation, but I think it does now.
Yeah.
How do you set that up? Because that's, we're talking a very small degree of possibilities and chances, but that's when it really matters, is when that would 1%, 10%.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that you can take this two different ways. The first one is based on RPD model and OODA loop stuff, where you can do your recognition and you know, you insert like experiences based on that and run the mental model in your brain to see if it's going to work. If it looks like a success, then you try it until conditions change or something happens that would cause you to have to deviate. For us, a lot of times we'll say, if you've tried twice, no more than three of certain thing, you know, for example, we're trying to use the spreaders to remove a door. If you've tried in the same spot three times and you're not getting what you need, you have to change something. On the other side of that, using being able to sit around and have a conversation and listen to guys and then take their experiences and build your mental Rolodex of things that, even if I've never done it before, I can kind of picture in my mind's eye what he's talking about, whatever that skill may be. And then if it's something with vehicle extrication that I've never done before with block and tackle or something crazy, but I understand what you're talking about. And then the situation presents where, like, hey man, we've tried plan A, we've tried plan B, we're starting to think about C and D. Is this thing that this guy told me about that I've never done a possibility? Can we truly execute that or not? Like, I think it's neat to have that conversation, because a lot of guys are like, man, I feel like I could be really good at what I have to do, but sometimes there are the need for some alternate move. But I think recognizing, hey man, I'm doing something, and the, you know, the definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over again, like, a lot of that is obviously time and condition sensitive for a lot of things that we do. But the cool thing about our job is that the pressure of having to act forces you to have to make a decision, and you have to act, you have to do something. So, like, that's one of my favorite things about it. You know, if you think about a building fire, a lot of times the guys will say, well, we saved the foundation, or we saved the block. Like, it's real easy to scale that out, right? On the more technical side of a lot of what we get to do, we have to perform an action. We have to get them out of the car. We have to get them out of the trench or out from the collapse or whatever the technical call is. We have to perform and we have to make it better. So that pressure is a cool thing in my mind. Like, pressure is a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah. With the same, pressure is a privilege.
Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah.
Being able to lean into
it means things are expected of you. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I appreciate that. I definitely follow, like, the rules of three. I tell that to my guys a lot. Like, you got three opportunities, and yeah, same thing. You have to pivot. With search being, I don't want to say like a hot topic, I mean, you have the firefighter rescue survey out there. It's gaining a lot of traction. They're putting out fantastic information, but then that's the bread and butter of what, like, the DC, like, any rescue, but especially with DC rescue, to save lives and, God forbid, save our own. If that situation ever comes to it, you know, you're teaching it in your rescue school. What are some of these hallmark things that, you know, with your traveling, what are some of the common errors you're seeing, or what are some of the big take-home messages that you wish more people focused on? Like, are you seeing common holes in our training? Are you seeing certain tactics that you wish people focused on more? Like what's our areas for improvement here to make us the most successful we possibly can be?
We're really fortunate right now. We have a bunch of different things going on in the realm of search in the district that are only going to make things a whole lot better. So our captain is involved in a separate search project with a guy, Jordan Legan from Seattle, where they're looking at different ways of being able to, you know, simple things, look at the front of the building and identify where the stairs are, or how to move through the building, how to package a victim, how to cover the spaces of a building efficiently, how to recognize searchable spaces that would hold a victim versus items in the building that we know there's nobody's going to be there, and to be able to move efficiently through the building while maintaining orientation. And then when you find the victim, how to package them properly and remove them. So there's as simple as it can be, it can also get really complex really quickly when you start talking about a method that you're going to use to maintain orientation while trying to cover a space, move efficiently. You know, what does that look like for a single person versus a team of two? What does that look like when conditions are A, B versus C? What does that look like when you have multiple victims? Is the engine company getting in line in service and able to protect the rescue operation? Or, you know, have we located a victim on the upper floors of even if it's the second floor of a house, and we're not able to shelter in place and we have to effect removal out a window because the fire is not in check yet? You know, having a process in place for removing the victim from the bed down to the window, down to the floor, to reduce their threat in the thermal layer, and then get them to an opening where we can get them the fresh air. And then how do we get them out of a window onto a ladder safely? There are a bunch of skills in a row. And when you look at firefighter rescue survey, like, people are found in their living spaces. They're brought out over a ladder if they're not brought down the interior stairs. We know that the majority of the time they're brought down the interior stairs, not the front door. But we basically said, hey, man, like, a vent or circle of a second floor with a rapid search of one room, or in our case, we don't really use the vent or search as much for searching one room. If we're going to make an alternate entry and go into the second floor, that's our point of entry for the search of the second floor. The whole saying of a search is a search. It doesn't matter what you want to call it, if it's how many letters or VES, VEIS, all that stuff. You know, so second floor point of entry, and then locating the victim and how to move them. It can get complicated if you wanted it to be. But then again, if we've practiced on all the different methods of removing a victim head first versus feet first, all the different drag options, and then, you know, how to cover that space appropriately, it kind of goes back to if then type of scenario in our brain. I located the victim head first. This is the move I'm going to use. I locate them feet first. I know how to drag them because I did it this way. I practiced this way. So a lot of things we do, we can have that conversation, but it all boils down to having the training, having done it physically, not just talked about it. Because there's a big difference between, I can sit here and talk to you about what I want to do with why my reasons are for that. I would prefer the victim to come head first out of window. Well, somebody else may disagree, but if you have never done that skill, you wouldn't know. So it's just it can get to be an interesting conversation when you start talking like that.
I mean, you spouted off probably 10 different things that could be its own 1 hour class, right?
Absolutely.
All those down. Yeah. The whole VES thing, like, I understand where it's come from, but for you, I don't mean to dumb it down too much, but like, all you're doing is creating a different entry point. Like, that second floor window is basically the same as the side alpha front door. You're just, it's like a little bit different to climb in and out of, right? Like, the search technique doesn't really change. You know what environment you're going into. You have awareness of the environment. You're orientating yourself, right? Not a whole lot is changing outside of you just having to get over the top of the sill, right?
Absolutely. You know, and that could just be as simple as the team that's going above the fire for us is trying to get in through the interior stairs, and there are two engine companies there stacked up trying to get their line moving, and we don't have the time to stand there and wait for them to move, and there's already a ladder to a second floor window. Hey, we're going to audible, and our entry point's going to be over a ladder instead of going through the interior stairs. Like, it's literally that simple. But, you know, or mom standing in the front yard saying, my kid's in that room. That's great. That's the starting point
Yeah.
We're not going to just isolate that door and then come back out and move the ladder to the next window unless some crazy condition prevents us from being able to do that. We're going to go in that window, isolate the door, do a search. And then after that search has been deemed negative in that room or whatever, if we found a victim, remove them. We're still going to go right back in that window, open the door and move on. Like,
you kind of answered my next question. I think so many people being creatures of habit and having the training scars are going to go right back out that window. But as long as conditions warrant, you're bumming out that bedroom door and you're hitting hallways, searching off of that. Like you're hitting the next bedrooms, right? You're not coming back out the window, rolling the ladder, going back up, as long as the conditions allow you to do that.
It's so easy to go down this path of like, I have to go back where I came from. And we talk about this all the time. And then we did a drill with the engine company. They had an acquired house that we were able to do pretty much anything except for like cutting inside and stuff like that. But a lot of like, we could run lines in there and do searches and stuff. They simulated a basement fire. The engine company stretches a line in the basement. We're in there doing a search. We came down through the interior stairs. And then next thing you know, there's a pass alarm going off. And the natural thought process is we've got to get this guy and take him back where we came from. So we started dragging this dude over to take him back up the interior stairs. And when we get there, we're immediately, you know, you got a guy 6'2", 200 and some pounds, plus his gear. I'd like to think I'm a pretty strong dude. We were struggling to get him up a couple steps.
Sure.
And, you know, the natural tendency is for all these guys to want to all get their hands on. And the lesson there was like, hey, man, a couple of you guys need to go see if you can find another option. Nice. And they go take a look. And a couple minutes into it, they find the walkout steps where we only had to go. You know, we had to drag them back across this one room. But then we've only got to move them up 5 steps to get them out of the environment versus having to come up a set of narrow, steep stairs and then navigate back through the building again. So getting yourself to a point where your brain develops part of that process to say, hey, we've located a fireman and one guy's addressing the air issue. Is there a need for packaging for vertical movement? You know, so do we have to do a conversion of some sort? If yes, then somebody's addressing that. Everybody else that's not hands-on, go find the easiest way out. And that applies for a civilian as well. Like, is it best for us to stay here and wait for conditions to improve because I can hear the line? Is it best for us to, you know, take the window and try to get their head out the window and let them at least get some fresh air until we're able to move? Or, hey, man, it doesn't sound like it's making it any better. We need to actually get them out of the building. So, you know, all those things play a part in it, but you got to have your mind at a point where you can understand that and make the decision based on what the conditions are presenting.
Man, that's super heads up. I like that you are taking a little bit of extra. Well, one, backing up, having the awareness of, okay, not everybody is being used right now. Let's delegate. Like, that's huge. And then let's take a couple extra seconds, go search other areas. And then what that did were, I think for so many people, they think it's wasting time or it's taking too long. All it did was actually make up time on the back end of all this. And I think so many people lose sight of, all right, it feels like it's going to take an extra minute, and it is, but that upfront investment of that 60 seconds just saved you 5 or 10 minutes on the back end of not having to go up into your set of steps when guys are getting physically, metabolically taxed.
Sure.
And yeah, I mean, that's super heads up. I wish more people had that awareness, but again, it goes back to sets and reps, making things second nature, so you have the bandwidth to be able to recognize that.
Yeah, I mean, you start having the conversation about in the sense of the VES or VEIS, right? I come in the second floor window and I'm moving over to isolate the door and I stumble across a victim. Do I grab that victim right away and take them to the ladder? Do I continue over to close the door? Do I look outside the door? You know, there are a lot of guys that will have varying answers for that. Like in my mind, go get over across to the door, scan the hallway to take a look. Number one, I can take a quick look for any other victims, take note of the thermal layer and see what the conditions are doing there, close the door. Now I've bought time for both of us in the room. I can move quickly. And then to finish that search of that room as well, because when I go out with a victim, now if it's a smaller room, obviously, now I can say this victim was located and the rest of that search was complete. as opposed to, well, I only got to a third of the room. Now they've got to search it all over again because they weren't there.
Yeah.
To understand your reference point. So it's really neat when you have that conversation, but some guys agree, disagree, obviously, but when you get to a point with your crew where you know what each other's play is, that's even better.
Yeah. A little investment, man. Yeah. It does a whole lot for you. Something in my presentation that I'll use a little bit deeper dive on are some of the systems when, whether it's civilian or a firefighter down. I know my bias was towards the fire mayday side of it. There are totally different systems out there, whether you make your own or you buy one of the name brands out on the market. There's a lot of great stuff. There's also a lot of trash, right? Is there something that DC recognizes or uses, or something that Squad 3 is focuses on, or how do you all, what are you deploying for, whether it's civilian or firefighter down? And I know that's maybe a deeper question, whether it's horizontal or vertical dregs or any of that, but yeah. I think the color coded 50 strap things, there's a lot of junk out there that doesn't work. So,
for sure.
You all have been tested. What are your go-to methods for that?
We, every member of the department has been issued a 20-foot piece of webbing and a carabiner. So we decided that we were going to work on whatever packaging options we could use to include that piece of webbing if we needed to, because everybody should have one. Really, after digging into firefighter rescue survey data and then just a whole bunch of sets and reps, we're like, hey, man, dirty drag is where it's at. Let's identify the methods for moving the victim horizontally through the building, head first and feet first. Have that plan coordinate with the removal options, whether that's downstairs or out a window, and have a plan for both. And then moving up and down the stairs, we would incorporate that webbing with a simple girth hitch. I mean, some guys use the ARS strap or different various ones, the AC rescue strap or whatever. And there's no preference either way. Just simply with the fact that the department's issuing this webbing, let's find a solution so that everybody has it available to them without having to spend that extra money on top of it. And I think that it's worked really well for us so far. We also do some stuff with lifting a victim using hand tools that would help get them out of window really easily. So it all just comes down to, like you said, sets and reps, guys knowing the plan and understanding, communicating. I've located the victim and their feet first towards the window. For me, that's ideal. I can dirty drag them by their legs, get them to the window, put their feet at the bottom of the window, slide their butt to their heels, and then the guy on the window on the ladder outside is able to help get them out. If it's a situation where we're second floor and conditions are improving, come down the interior stairs with a method that protects their head from getting beat on every step on the way out, then we're winning.
Awesome. Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah, one, the department is supporting everybody with at least something. And then when you do, you're like, hey, listen, this is what's given to us. Let's be the best that we can be. And here are the options. And here's basically the playbook for this simple piece. That's nice. Just really quickly for the hand tool bit. I know, I think it's common to use hand tools as basically a fulcrum and lever, or whether it's going through straps. Yeah. What are just really quick down and dirty for some of the folks who may not have that kind of experience? How are you using those hand tools for getting people in and out?
So it doesn't matter if it's a civilian or a firefighter. Obviously your body's natural, the way that we're built. If a person's laying on their back and we try to lift them up by their shoulders or their legs, they want to fold in half like a taco. So if we're trying to bring a victim out of a window or any kind of a area where they have to be lifted, then we would put the firefighter or the civilian face down. If you take the Halligan bar and put it basically where their armpit is, come just behind their shoulders and across their chest, so it sits where their sternum is, essentially. One guy on one side and one on the other. You can do it with two people on a fairly large victim, and it works really well. One guy grabs one side of the bar, one on the other, and then grab a leg, or even for a civilian, if you just need to initially help get them up into the windowsill, using that bar across their chest, your body's tendency to fold in half when you're face down is not there. It's more rigid. Your spine is only going to flex so much. So that gives you the ability to lift them up. You can start getting them out the window, and then we can go to their legs. It's even easier with a firefighter that has gear on, because now I can grab the Halligan bar with one hand and I can grab your pants by the pocket or just grab some material and two of us can lift you up and pull you out the window pretty easily. It's even easier if you have a hook because it's longer and you have more leverage, but it all depends on space. So, you know, like for us, all five members of the rescue company are carrying a Halligan bar. That's something that we just have built into our play for being able to move a civilian or a victim up out of a window.
Yeah, nice. Not good. The hand tools, with you mentioning what people are carrying, so everybody's generally speaking carrying a Halligan bar. When you are going into forcible entry and or roof work,
yep.
Me being the captain of the truck, we have a massive toolbox. We're pretty well resourced where I'm at. There's definitely a push for battery operated stuff, and there's 50 different blades and all kinds of stuff that's out there. Yeah. What are you all carrying, and what is some of the, like, what's your go-to? Like, there's definitely things like, oh, this is nice to have, but this is a very specific situation. Yeah. Like some of our smaller battery saws, it's quick, very clean environments.
Yeah.
But otherwise, like, if anything's worth its weight in salt, more challenging incidents, like, those are not the ones to grab. Like, what are y'all using?
Some stuff is the same for every box on that we'll run. So for my shift, for squad three, I'm up to the team that's going to the fire. One of those guys will take the DeWalt 9-inch battery operated saw, the rotary saw, and then both members are taking their Halligan bar. We all have Bullard NXT thermal imaging cameras. And then if it's a multi-occupancy, one member of each team would take the Hydroram. For the team that's going above the fire, one of the A-team member coming out of the back of the rescue will take the Anderson Rescue Solutions roof rope bag that has a highlighter kit on it as well. So it's a two-in-one system. Yeah. Could be doubled as the roof rope kit or as a highlighter, two-to-one for removing a firefighter or a civilian out of a window using a ladder as a two-to-one.
Yeah,
we don't carry the five members on the rescue do not carry an axe or a maul as a primary, but if you knew you were going to the rear of a commercial and you anticipated something a little more fortified and you need that extra hitting power, we could. We are well-versed in using two Halligan bars to get through the majority of what we work with just because we're used to one guy driving the other one in. You know, the truck companies, the guy that's riding the bar on the truck does carry a set of irons together. So there are some axes in the mix, but it's not something that we carry as part of it. We could if we needed to, and we obviously have those on the rig. It's just not something that's coming off right away. The only other things that we would come out of the gate with is if we're going commercial or something where we hear initial size up of roll-up gates, then we would take the bigger saws. We have the gas-operated, you know, rotary saws, the 950s and whatnot, that would come out of our compartment. And then in a RIT operation, we also have the DeWalt chainsaw. Nice. So if you're running a smoky environment, be able to cut the floor or whatever we need to do there. So
yeah. Okay. So we're pretty similar in that regard then for what we're carrying. A lot of partner gas powered stuff, all different kinds of blades. We're trying to make a push for, we do carry a lot of Milwaukee. There was some differences between the specials where I'm at, but they're trying to, for continuity, and I guess from what they learned at Stricker, just we're basically starting to create a cache of just Milwaukee stuff, and we've got everything from the 9-inch, and I think we're starting to test some of like the full grade commercial stuff, battery, gas. I said, pretty well resourced, but we got it all.
Yeah, we did the same thing. We took some of the information from Stricker, from their reports, and from obviously mutual friends that we all know, and kind of expanded our RIT operation a little bit with a confined space line that's a 100-foot hose. It has a Schrader fitting on both ends, but the male end can fit into it can fit into the female connection on our RIT bag, and then it has a double female on the far end. So you take the double female to the down firefighter. You could connect their EBSS into one side, and then if you had a guy working to conserve his air, you could put them on the same system or, you know, to supply someone that's working there. We also have a high-pressure solution that is a double male. It would connect right into the RIT bag instead of the cylinder, and then we could run an air hose from our air truck to it and connect it, and then we would have high pressure. The problem with that is that hose is only 200 feet, so... Once the box alarm gets stacked up, I don't know if that would get close enough to be able to be effective, but it's an option.
So. Yeah, sure. Just recently, you were you got to hang out with was it Champo and who else were you with?
Chief Cassetta, JJ Cassetta from Orlando, and then there's a lieutenant from Ladder 45, a backstep fireman from Squad 41, Mike Hayes and Paul Hoxima, Champo, JJ Cassetta, and it was a couple guys from Boston, a couple guys from Providence. It was a good time.
Yeah, you were having a good time, man. I think it was last year I got to hang out with Champ. It was his first, like, conference back after all of his cancer treatments. And to see him back on the floor has been pretty cool.
Yeah. But
getting to rub elbows with, like, some awesome people, and you begin doing tons of traveling, man, which has been awesome.
Good time.
Yeah. What, if you could, we're both, you know, involved with the traditions guys. I mean, like, you're in it deep with traditions. I'm always trying to recommend, you know, when people ask me, hey, what training company are out there that can come do stuff? Like, Traditions is like one of the first ones that come up. So, like, if you could, what Traditions is and what they offer, just to get that out there, because people are always looking for good companies, man.
Yeah. So, guys from all over the country that are vetted, super experienced, respected guys in the fire service that have been going all over, sharing a good word and doing a lot of stuff with lecturing and hands on. You know, Chief Riley and Sammy Hiddle and Dan Shaw and, you know, Doug and Roger, a bunch of these guys are just out there making connections and kind of help people get through, you know, understanding the basic stuff and how to be better. And it's really been quite an honor to be a part of it. Very fortunate to have been connected with Roger and these guys to be able to do it. And it's been a lot of fun to, even if it's just one thing, to be able to have a conversation with somebody and change their perspective or help them get a little bit better. And you never know what kind of influence or effect you're going to have on either someone's career, or, you know, they may take something that you've talked about and it may change someone else's life through their actions. So it's a pretty cool conversation to think that you can go out there and talk about that kind of stuff. And then also just share, like, hey man, I'm just a guy from a small one or two stoplight town that chased my dreams and was able to truly achieve my dream job being a squad driver in a city. And, you know, that you can do the same thing and be able to go do this and be able to meet new people and share your passion. Like, it's a lot, it's a pretty humbling experience to be able to do that. So, you know, I can't thank those guys enough for the opportunities that they've given me already and for, you know, helping me out and stepping out there. So.
Yeah. Hell yeah, man. No, it's a great group of people. I mean, any type of hands-on to include lecture, even apparatus specing, like, the experience bank runs deep. So yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. If anybody out there is interested, they're it's a one-stop shop, man.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm hoping to be able to do more with either like drill night stuff, you know, whether it would be a lecture or, you know, drill night hands-on 2 or 3 hour class or 1 and 2 day weekend classes would be a lot of fun, more locally. Like, it's fun to travel, but at the same time, it'd be cool to be able to do some stuff closer to home. So definitely trying to push that forward if it works out.
Yeah, for sure. Where can people find you and reach out? Obviously there's a website, but there's a lot of other ways to get a hold of you.
Yeah. If they reach out for info@traditionstraining.com, I think is the email address that usually gets them in contact with them, or I'm easy to find on Instagram and TikTok. I like to play around with them a little bit. So, boys on there or Facebook, it doesn't matter, whatever. Hey, any of those options, if somebody wants to get something going, I'd be glad to help out however I can.
Yeah, heck yeah, man. I know we're banging on close to an hour and we both got kids stuff going on here in a little bit. Is there any, I could nerd out on stuff for like another hour with you, but is there anything you want to close up with?
No, we just been fortunate to have a lot of cool experiences lately. You know, I'm going to be going to Wichita for Into the Job in June, and then we're going to be in Pittsburgh in August, and then Arkansas in September. So anybody in those areas that wants to catch up, you know, whatever, it'd be a great time to sit around and chat. The sidebar conversations at these conferences and hands-on training is where it all happens. You know, it's cool to have the formal instruction or have a formal conversation, but breaking bread or having a drink together afterwards is so much fun, just to get to really know people. And, you know, we got to spend some time hanging out, and the message was really fun. Like, hey man, I think it's time for our relationship to go to the next level. Here's my phone number. Like, You just don't see that in other trades and other things. So like the fire service really is something special, you know, to have relationships that we have and be able to affect the change that we do. And it's just really, you know, it's a really cool thing, and really blessed to be a part of it. And just, you know, the opportunities and experiences to be able to share that, it's pretty cool. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Hell yeah, man. You said it well. Sometimes those hotel lobby beers or those, you know, events late at night are where some of the best conversations happen. So yeah, we've had a ton of mutual friends. It's been awesome to finally connect with you over the last year, man.
Absolutely.
Really appreciate everything. But yeah, that's a good place to end to wrap up.